Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for being here. We have a very special announcement to make today, and it will be the unveiling presentation of the Kisselman Trailhead, the Kisselman Pure Energy Park, and the Muncie Arts and Culture Trail. I'd like to thank the Muncie Delaware County Indiana Economic Development Alliance for coordinating everything today. Thank you for all of you coming out in this wonderful weather that we're having in Muncie and Delaware County today. But I think at the end of this 60 to 90 minute presentation, ladies and gentlemen, that you all agree that this is probably the most significant project in the history of the city of Muncie and Delaware County, and the impact that that's going to have on the 100 plus thousand people that live here and commute every day. I don't think anybody would ever deny that East Jackson Corridor area is an area that for many years has needed some transformation. And to be able to put together a project like this with 22 different partners being involved in it, bringing everybody together from IDEM, NDOT, foundations, elected leaders, community leaders, and everything, to be able to present an announcement today that has been decades and decades in the making. You know, you go back and you look at our history, ladies and gentlemen, if you look at the Ball family and their importance in this great community of ours, they had a vision for one of our most natural assets that we have in this community, and that's White River. And from decades ago to today, they have never quit moving forward and investing in ways to turn this White River into one of our most natural assets. When you look at what the Ball Brothers Foundation and the other foundations have done, men and women like John Craddock and others in this great community, what we are going to be unveiling today is so very, very special. So sit back and listen to the presenters. You're going to be amazed at what you're going to see on the screens and what you're going to hear. So thank you so much for being here today.
Hello, my name is Phil Tevis, and I'm with a company called Flatland Resources, and we're the project managers for the Kisselman Trailhead area. And I'm going to try to frame some history so that each speaker has an ability to put context into this overall presentation. Okay, so I'm going to go back in history because it's very important to understand that each generation forms its own relationship with a river or any natural resource. And in Muncie, the big boom, the gas boom, the Trenton oil gas well, led to mass growth in the city of Muncie. We advertised around the country. This is, in fact, a real advertisement by the early beginnings of the Chamber of Commerce, where they lured many industries from the East Coast to Muncie. It brought factories like Ball, Hemingway, and many, many others, including the Kitzelmans. Here's the Kitzelman factory. And you have to understand that the city of Muncie in the 1880s was a very small agricultural community. And from 1880 to 1913 or 1910, the city grew in eightfold, and there was 6,000 factory jobs. We were kind of like China at the time. But what didn't occur is an understanding of the river itself. One thing we did was we discharged a lot of pollutants into the river. That's the reason why people came, free gas and a way to get rid of your waste. And then in the 1913s and thereabouts, there were many floods, and the focus of the community shifted in the next generation to trying to contain the waters. We built many levees, one of them being along Elm Street. And moving to the Depression, and for whatever reason, the city of Muncie was chosen to be Middletown. Everybody knows the Middletown story, I hope. But the reason they chose it is more or less we were in the geographic center of the United States. We were 50% of the city, the nation was above us, 50% of the nation was below, east and west. And they did a lot of study. And they basically, in very simple terms, divided the city into two sectors, the working class and the home of the business class. They came back after the Depression, and these factories were here, and I'm going to read, this being the Kitzelman factory, and I read a little bit of an excerpt of some of what occurred during this time period. It becomes really relevant. In the 1930s, a decade-long controversy concerning the river pollution and the construction of a sewer interceptor and the sewage treatment plant permeated the city. The White River had become badly polluted with domestic and industrial wastes. A proposed sewer system divided Muncie down political lines. The Democrats opposed the sewers, while the Republicans supported it. The Democrats were generally the South Side working class, while the Republicans were the North Side business class. There were many concerns about the Democrats, by the Democrats, that the proposed sewage system was being installed to clean up for the elite homes along Ball Bluff. In 1924, when Robert Lynn, the Lynns that did the Middletown studies, came, they made notes and found the condition of the river deplorable. When they returned after the Depression, they followed up in their Middletown studies revisited, they found that nothing had been done to improve the situation. In 1930, Mayor Dale was elected. He had been in office for less than a month when Dr. William King, the secretary of the Indiana State Board of Health, began to pressure him to take immediate steps to prevent the continued defilement of the White River in Muncie. The mayor, who was a Democrat, refused, beginning a two-year confrontation between Dale and King. King received ammunition for his offensive against Muncie when in October 1930, the State Department of Sanitary Engineering concluded a five-year study of the White River. The study described the waterway as having the appearance and odor of an open sewer. The report charged contamination by Muncie rendered the drinking water of Anderson unsafe for human consumption. The report also substantiated Dale's claim that industry contributed heavily to the pollution. The Ball Brothers paper mill and several other factories like Ontario and Kitsilman were some of the major sources. The end result was the WPA, ironically managed by a Ball family member, built an interceptor and the wastewater pollution control facility. Later, a Muncie Parks Commission was formed by another group of people in the community, and another Ball family member was on that commission. It was Edmund F. Ball. The commission unveiled a plan to build a boulevard park that was to extend upstream near the wire mill through Whiteley, past McCullough Park, through Ball Bluff, past Ontario Silver, and west to Tui, to the West Side Park. Some of the major other works were Tui Pool and White River Boulevard and the Appeal to the Great Spirit. I want to kind of frame that and go back to the fact that in this Lynn study, they came back in the second time and they talked a great deal about two groups in the community, a Y family and an X family. The X family was the Ball family, and they, on the long term, continued to remain in the community and invest through philanthropy, and then the Kitzelman family that slowly left the community, but the wire mill remained. These are the Ball brothers and the Kitzelman. So when the Lynns returned to the community, this is what they found. This is a picture taken that was commissioned by the Muncie Parks Commission, taken from the Washington Street looking down what is today White River Boulevard. They unveiled this plan to build a boulevard and trail, a boulevard system from the east side of the community to the west side of the community. Some of the major outworks was the first levee. This is the view looking from Wheeling Avenue to the courthouse. And they began to dredge the river. One of the last things that happened during this period was the gift from Ed Ball to the city on behalf of his dad was the Appeal to the Great Spirit. And this has become the city symbol and part of that commitment to the ongoing desire to build a recreational area along the river. If you move forward into this next generation, the only thing that really occurred from the 1930s until the 1970s was the Army Corps of Engineers took on a 15-year effort to build large levees in the city of Muncie. And anyone that's baby boom generation or older will know this picture. Muncie was in no different condition than the United States at large. The Clean Water Act came about, and the city of Muncie, through the Muncie Bureau of Water Quality, were able to actually work on cleaning the river. Without the cleaning of the river, the parks planned by the Muncie Park Commission in 1913 was set for failure. So with that, I'm going to introduce John Craddock, who, incidentally, I learned last night when John and I were talking about this picture. And he said, oh, do you remember the Indian that's crying? He goes, I met him. He came to Muncie, and I took him up and down the river. So, John, we're ready. We're ready for you.
Thank you. Well, unfortunately, after we built our wastewater treatment plant, we really didn't run it like we should. So, therefore, we had industrial waste both coming into the river and into our wastewater treatment plant, wiping it out every several weeks. And the importance of that is that when you wipe out your wastewater treatment plant, you, in essence, have the equivalent of about 20 to 30 million gallons a day of raw sewage going directly to the river, because it takes about a week for the bacteria in that plant to regenerate itself. So in March of 1972, I was fortunate enough to have the opportunity to start the Bureau of Water Quality, and we set up a holistic program. So it's one of the oldest local water pollution agencies in the United States, and it handles general stream pollution, industrial pretreatment, which is the control of toxic and hazardous waste with inside of an industry, biological and chemical stream monitoring, the testing for that large wastewater plant to make sure it meets its federal and state permit, various research projects, emergency response such as for fish kills, oil spills, acid dumps, those type of things, and the establishment of river wildlife habitat restoration. Generally speaking, if you notice, generally the south bank through town, except for every once in a while, is generally where you've got your heavy growth. The north side is generally where we've developed the trails and for human use. If we develop both sides of the river, you will drive the wildlife that has come back outside of town. So that's why we need one side left fairly undeveloped, other than areas, for instance, like the river development at the entrance to Muncie, downtown. Those type of things are okay. We start wiping out 1-2 miles at a time, and all of a sudden you will stop the movement of your wildlife. The White River starts as a bubbling spring up by Winchester. We're the first major community on the upper West Fork of the White River. So we knew back in the early 70s that if we started to clean our river, it would stay clean because we didn't have a Muncie, Anderson, or Indianapolis above us. This was our wastewater treatment plant in the late 60s and the early 70s. Definite degradation to the White River from a variety of reasons. We primarily had primary and secondary treatment. We didn't have chlorination, dechlorination, third stage treatment. Approximately $50 million has been spent by various sanitary district boards and mayors over the last 45 years to improve this facility to where it's now a top grade facility. They said you've got 10 minutes, and anybody that knows me, it's hard to say hello on the street in 10 minutes. So I'm going to ask Phil if he'll give me a 2-minute warning on my 10-minute. Okay, good deal. So I took 4 thumb drives of water pollution talks and put them together for a 10-minute talk. So what I want to try to leave you with is just how bad it was, where we came from, what it took to clean it up, where we are now. That's if we can accomplish that, then we've done it. We had a whole variety of sources of water pollution problems. This was animal kill blood directly into a tributary to the White River that flowed through one of the city parks in town. Car wash discharges used to go directly into the White River, and benzene complexes, phosphates, anything that would come off of a car. CSOs, combination sewer overflows, flowing into the to the White River, of which is presently being worked on. As a matter of fact, and one of a few unknown facts is Muncie was actually one of the first that actually separated a system back in 86. We had a CSO down at Westside Park that caused about 4 fish kills. And so back in 86, actually, is when the start of the separation of CSOs in Muncie actually began. So it's not something just new that's just started in the last 5 years. Raw sewage discharges. We used to have 200 illegal raw sewage discharges coming directly into the White River. Those have been eliminated, disconnected, hooked into the sanitary sewer system. The end result of what you've seen is from organic waste. So what you're looking at is a highly clogged White River. This is what it looked like in the 70s. This is just about 100 feet downstream from West Jackson Street Bridge. This was why our community and most communities across the United States drove across their rivers, did not use them for recreational purposes. Do not forget, this is the same period of time that the Calumet River, for instance, was burning. We had rivers in the United States that were on fire. That's how polluted they were. Now we're going to move into toxic waste discharges, industrial discharges. We had them coming into the plant, and we had them coming into the river. This is plating waste. It's chromic acid, attacks all mucous membranes. This is in a city park. We've seen children swing on that rope. You disconnect it from the river. You have the industry put in pretreatment and hook it into the sanitary sewer system with a permit from the Bureau of Water Quality. Oil discharges used to come directly into the White River. Same type of operation for solving the problem. Oil spills used to happen. These are oil boom dams, and then bring in trucks to suck the oil off the top of the White River. This was commonplace. We had 10 fish kills from 1970 to 1986. All but one was man-made, one was natural. There are natural fish kills. Some are summer, some are winter, lack of oxygen in the water from low water, high temperatures. Warm water does not hold as much oxygen as cold water, and therefore you can have a natural fish kill. And those happened a million years ago also. One of the reasons we're here is for the development of KPEC, which was the old Kitzelman site, which was the Indiana Steel and Wire site, changed names over a period of time. This was a discharge out of Mox Pond. This is what it used to look like. Bottom half, you cannot see the bank, 50% coverage of the White River. It used to be orange, red for several blocks in that area. Contained a variety of heavy metals, primarily zinc, copper, and cyanide, but the two primary ones were zinc cyanide. Those are also the ones that caused the groundwater contamination. The Bureau worked with Indiana Steel and Wire on that, and here's your after effect first. This is after Mox Pond has been cleaned, capped, IDEM and EPA approved. And that slide's not upside down. That's a reflection from the sky on the water. This was a discharge out of the north entrance to the old Indiana Steel and Wire site. Again, disconnect from the stream, require pretreatment to be put in. Permit applications. Permit to discharge into the sanitary sewer with limits. Automatic samplers by our department put on all of the industries. Then they are required to sample. Reports are sent quarterly down to the state. And this is what pretreatment looks like. It's physical, mechanical pieces of equipment that the industry is required to install. If it's cyanide, it may be a chlorination unit to destroy the cyanide. If it's heavy metals, it may be settling tanks to settle that. If it's oil, it may be oil separation units. So each one depends on the type of the pollution problem that we're talking about. Those samples then come back into our lab, and a highly sophisticated lab with a highly experienced, well-educated staff to the point that I believe they're up to somewhere around 19 or 20 state lab awards now. I've been retired for a while, so I don't know where they're at right now. End result, a lot that you've seen are fish kills. And like I said, we had 10 fish kills. We haven't had any since 1986. And also, because of all the cleanup, when we first started, we had 30 species of fish. Some areas of the river we had 4 species of fish. We now have 65 species of fish. It's a very good smallmouth stream. Yes, you can eat the sports fish out of the White River. There is a Department of Natural Resources brochure that's put out, some of the fatty tissue in your carp and some of those fish one does have to be careful of. Pregnant women, children under a certain age. But that's true pretty much across the state of Indiana and the Midwest. Generally speaking, we find that most of what you'll see in there is either PCB or mercury. Do not forget that about 80% of our mercury comes in airborne over our state boundaries from sources we have no control over. So how did we work with the industrial community? I think it's important because it's the same concept of what's going on today. We formed a partnership with the industrial community. We formed a Muncie Industrial Clean Water and Waste Management Council made up of every industry in this town, plus the Bureau of Water Quality, and we met once a month for about the first 15 years of the Bureau in one of their conference rooms around town so that everybody knew that they were being treated fairly and the same. Plus, we worked on budgetary schedules and installation of equipment. We issued one fine in 31 years. We did not put one industry out of business. We did not lose one job because of the environmental control. So this is your end result. Just to give you a general idea, the yellow is where we started. The red is where we ended up. Zinc, lead, nickel, copper, chrome, cyanide, which technically is not a metal, but it's still of a high concern, cadmium. This is what used to be discharged into the river. approximately 17.4 tons annually that are no longer going into the river. And this is the fun part now. Because of what's been done by a variety of people and a variety of partnerships, we now have a nice wildlife population along the river. You don't have to go out to the country. We have a deer herd along there. The red-tailed hawk has come back. American coots come back. Mallards have come back. Muskrats come back. We have 4 beaver families in town. Yellow-crowned night heron has come back. The green heron has come back. And the green heron is interesting, too, because the highest population of green herons are one half block down from the site that we're talking about today on the total development. So that's another little addition to it that I don't know if it's are in the statistics any place. The blue herons have come back, and I know you've easily seen those. But also, the American egret has come back, and it's 54 inches tall. This is now our White River versus the way it was in the 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s. And and now I'm gonna jump back 40 years. The bicentennial for Muncie, after 4 years of actually getting some of the discharges out, and the newspapers were with us very well and really supported the effort. And that played a large portion. Every 2-3 weeks there was an article in the newspaper about what was going on with the White River and the cleanup for years and years and years. And I cannot tell you how much that helped educate the public and really helped keep the movement going. So in 1976 was the bicentennial. And the mayor at that time contacted the Bureau and said that there was some Department of Natural Resource grant money available and to see if we could apply for it. And we worked with the Parks Department. And so it went through the Parks Department and we wrote a grant. And so the actual first overlook and the actual first physically built trail in Muncie was in 1976, and it was a gravel trail, And so the overlook is still there, but of course, now we have this wonderful paved trail. And with that, that's my segue back into Phil. Thank you.
I don't think anybody can say enough for what John's done to help the community. So with the river being clean, the city begins to refocus a new generation and begin to think about how to use the river again. And one of the things that came about was a master plan and a vision for the Minnetrista Cultural Center. And one of the big outcomes of the building of the Minnetrista Cultural Center is it took this road. If anybody remembers it, you could drive from one end of the town to the other at 60 miles an hour if you wanted to. And people would fight to get on Wheeling Avenue. And they decided, through Rondell Ernstberger's effort and the design team at Minnetrista, to create a pedestrian connection to the river instead of an automobile connection, including connections to Central High School. This is in 1987. About the same time, 1987, the city and the community at large decided it's time to rethink its whole downtown area. A Central City Master Plan was created. In many ways, we're still implementing parts of that plan to this day, including just recently Canaan Commons, Walnut Street. But what's real important to understand here is if you look, Minnetrista's on the right, and there was a vision to continue to connect to the river as a part of the system, the vision. About the same time, kind of on the side, 5 years later, two small ad hoc groups kind of form in the early 1990s. One's the Cardinal Greenway, and one's the White River Corridor Development Committee. One's focused on White River, one's on Cardinal Greenway. The Cardinal Greenway vision started out as just a regional trail, which later merged into a statewide trail which connects coast to coast. Most folks know that story. They intentionally, and the leaders at the time, people may remember Bill Skinner, Dave Ferguson, Bill Peterson, there are many others, Bruce Moore, they decided to, at the beginning of this, to build the trail intentionally from the White River to Prairie Creek Reservoir, thereby connecting our two greatest natural resources in the community. And from that first 10 miles, the city began to understand and use the culture of trail. At the same time, this White River Greenway vision, through John's guidance, Tom Smith, I probably forget everybody, Dave Sursa, Frank Ball, John Pruce, Doug Bakken, myself, Marta Moody, there were a lot, Owen Glenn Denning at Minnetrista, tried to continue to figure out how to expand the vision along the White River. And what was decided very simply was, let's build a trail. Nobody knew how to pay for it, but it was decided what we could start with are a series of overlooks. And by building overlooks, we could thread them together with a ribbon of trail. And what was really neat is it was decided to use the university. A Ball State student, a graduate, did this conceptual master plan. Kind of a kickoff to this was the West End Overlook over by Hawthorne. And then Minnetrista had to upgrade the boulevard, and they did the boulevard kind of to move this along. There was no trail there. Oop, wrong direction. And a series of overlooks were built. And these were actually community-based projects by Ball State University. These students from the College of Architecture and Planning or Landscape Architecture Department actually designed and built these overlooks. There are five of them. Most people know them. They were there before the trails. This is one over by Whiteley. And eventually, money came and the trail got built. And this is the unique thing about building a trail. The second it's paved, somebody's on it. That asphalt is still hot. That's how important trails are to communities. Here they are, paving the trail. And again, in 2000, the community started looking at comprehensive planning. And it came out in these comprehensive plans that the White River Greenway and the Cardinal Greenway were two critical things to the future of our quality of life. And they identified an area there. See where it says area of lacking park lands? That is Indiana Steel and Wire, or generally that area. A master plan was created outside of the university using Rondell Ernstberger for the White River Greenway. There was a focus on the Indiana Steel, a lot of things, but Indiana Steel and Wire area. This is kind of skewed, but there was a realization that there needed to be a connection between the White River Greenway and Cardinal Greenway. And the best place to do that was near the wire mill. The vision at that time was very simple: build a bridge and a parking lot and connect the two trails. NES Steel and Wire was still in business, and the dam was still being used for water intake. A challenge in this area is that everything in red is a brownfield or a Superfund site. There in yellow is Craddock Wetland. We'll talk about that in a minute. And move forward in time. Now, how do you implement all this? Because the logistics of building a bridge and a trailhead and all that get really tricky. You got to acquire land. You got to get Indiana Steel and Wire degree. You got to get an IDEM degree. And the community kind of behind the scenes said, well, let's work around it. So the community started to work on the John M. Craddock Wetland Nature Preserve, Phillips Pool. I think there's some representatives here. It's an important dive facility. The Hughes Nature Preserve, which included Redtail Nature involved in that project. Rotary Park or Card Doctors, also Ball State projects, and a vision for Mox Pond that hasn't been implemented yet. So we're kind of honing in around this vision of how to build a trailhead. The Craddock Wetland Nature Preserve was done, again, using Ball State University students to design and build the project. And now we're kind of rehoning back on how do we focus on this trailhead itself, the Kitzelman Trailhead. At the time, it was labeled the Kitzelman Trailhead. And more vision was created. And then we went back to the university again. And we used the College of Architecture and Planning through a process called Design Week. And Design Week is an effort where all the students work for 1 week on one project to come up with one vision. And they came up with visions for Kitzelman Trailhead. And it's very important to understand these visions because, in this one in particular, if you take a look what's in this thing, you're going to see it over and over from here forward in the presentations. A suggestion to relocate Bunch Boulevard, a suggestion to put the bridge on the south side of State Road 32, and to reform the land into mounds and put parking lots on both sides, east and west of East Jackson Street. While that was going on, kind of fortuitously, the county commissioners were dealing with Bridge 85, or the Albany Bridge up in Albany. It was old, it was in bad disrepair. NDOT and the historic preservation folks at the DNR said this is a very important bridge. It was actually manufactured in Muncie at the Indian Bridge Company, one of the longest continuous businesses in Muncie. That bridge had to be replaced for heavier traffic, and it either had to stay there or find a new home. And ironically, the new home was Cardinal Greenway. And Cardinal Greenway entered into an agreement with NDOT and the DNR that they would, and once the county commissioners were finished, that they would take possession of the bridge and find a new home for it. The new home is the Kitzelman Trailhead. And from that, early renditions were created to create conversations locally on how to move this thing to a greater vision and continuing on that. And while that is going on, there's also clear recognition in the community that it's not just the Kitzelman Trailhead that's happening here, that we have to integrate the city with the White River Greenway, the Cardinal Greenway. We have to find a way to connect the university, Minnetrista, and downtown together in a network of trails to improve the quality of life. And from that, Judd Fisher is going to talk a little bit about the efforts that the Ball Brothers Foundation has put into focusing on the East End to create the movement of today.
Thank you, Phil. And thank you to Barry Banks for letting me steal this slide years ago, and I've used it again and again. Thank you, sir. I just want to talk a little bit about Ball Brothers Foundation and some of the other foundations that have been involved with this. You heard some of the names of some of the former Ball Brothers board members that were involved with the Cardinal Greenway years ago. That during the conceptual days, 1993, I think, is when things started. 26 years ago, am I doing math right? 23. When I came on board in 2003 with Ball Brothers Foundation, my predecessor, Doug Bakken, told me that, you know, we have this connector, this thing running through our neighborhoods, urban areas, winding through rural areas. It's going to be very long through several counties called Cardinal Greenway, and I got involved with that. Very early in my tenure at Ball Brothers Foundation. But Doug said, one of the things we want to look at is when we have this connector to all these communities And you already heard about the purposeful connecting of the White River to Prairie Creek. When we have these things, let's look at areas that we can concentrate on. And this was one of those areas that Doug showed me and said, we need to look at other organizations around in this area. So since 1993 to now, Ball Brothers Foundation has been the largest funder at $2.3 million, just under $2.3 million on the Cardinal Greenway. And so we've been able to be part of that that whole process of conceptual to build out. And we're very excited about this economic development tool, this amenity for the community that is great for our health, great as a linear park, and being able to see all those kinds of things outdoors that make us feel good as we're walking around outdoors and checking out nature. It's been an honor to be part of that. The other part of this, and I was given 1.5 minutes to do my thing, and I asked for three so I could figure out my two slides. But the other part of this is has to be setting the stage for ideas like you're seeing today when you're a impact funder like Ball Brothers Foundation is. And so we tried to, for an example, just tried to help out with different projects around here. I'll point out a couple of them besides the greenway that flows through there, and there's a little better view of it on the next slide. But down the bottom is Car Doctors. You remember how bad that was. Some of you remember how bad that was. We put several dozen thousand dollars, I don't remember the total, about $40,000 into that through Ball State to help clean that up right next to the Rotary Park there and right next to the Greenway. So that's a corridor thing we were looking at a long time ago. Doug Bakken actually had me look at Car Doctors many years ago when Rotary Park was going in to see how we could help with any efforts there, and it's come a long way. But just some of the other things, Phillips Outdoor Center, we've helped out a little bit there with Tom Laird's organization. Craddock Wetland has been a real treat to be part of. Funding there and all the powerful partnerships that came out of that with Soil and Water Conservation District, Redtail, the city, probably missing some folks, but we put over $500,000 into that wetland to bring it back, and that was really great, and again, setting the stage in this area. And now, I went back. Sorry, I had one job. So now you're going to see this again and again, and you've seen it out here, and it's just a fantastic idea that's bloomed out of here. But my predecessor and Doug and my board have always told me, you know, keep concentrating on this area. Go ahead and look at the different requests you get from different organizations around here. And we did that, and we hope we've helped build that up and think we've been very purposeful in our concentrating on that geographic footprint. And it's so exciting to see this today. I'll take off my Ball Brothers hat real quick. I was 8 years as staff member part-time for another foundation with the Ball name on it, the Edmund F. and Virginia B. Ball Foundation. 2006, that foundation started funding a White River project with CEP, who you hear from next, Community Enhancement Projects. And it was a different project. And I took the job in 2007 part-time with that foundation. And in 2009, CEP came to me and said, hey, we're gonna change things up if you don't mind. So I had to go back to my that's a completely different organization, different board. I had to go back to that board and tell them that our $500,000 is gonna go to something else, it's gonna be a bridge. And so I will wind up with that now, but $500,000 in the payout, I think, ended this year after 10 years to CEP to set the stage for purchasing the bridge. And, you know, that's the center point of, it's the thinner angled part of that picture there right in the middle that's kind of the connector, the wonderful thing that'll bring the White River Greenway together with the Cardinal Greenway and be able to get people from here to, you know, up and down 65 miles of Cardinal Greenway to all the amenities and all the wonderful things in our community and beyond. So this is a really exciting day, and I appreciate being able to be here. It's a privilege, and thank you very much. So, Phil.
Is this working? Is this working? Okay. Tom Smith is the next speaker, and he's going to talk about the Community Enhancement Project. They are the group that has been spearheading the White River Greenway and the Kitzelman Trailhead in many ways for more than 25 years.
Well, good morning, folks. It's nice to see such a large crowd here this morning. Community Enhancement Projects is a 25-year-old community organization composed of 15 and sometimes as many as 20 local volunteers with a keen interest in improving the beauty of our city. Our purpose is to work primarily on landscape projects which improve the attractiveness and the beauty of our community. Hopefully, this ongoing enhancement effort will bring new business investment to our city. Sherman and Marjorie Ziegler should be given the credit for starting and supporting this local effort. Their goal was to enhance the natural beauty of the city and the banks of the White River. An example of their effort is Fireman's Park. And that's standing on the north side looking north back toward number one fire station. And this was something they did back in the 90s. And it's, as you might remember, and I don't have a picture of it to show you, but it was an abandoned vacant lot, concrete surface, looked much like the Kittleman site today. So that's what can be done with a vision. And their interest, along with Earl Williams, who was head of the Community Foundation, set up $25,000 a year funding for 4 years to kickstart our group's activities. CEP has become very effective in the continuation and the vision and the major efforts to enhance the various areas of our community. During the 90s, an ad hoc committee called the Trailblazers was formed to raise money for their vision of a trail along the banks of the White River. And you'll see the area there in red is tying all the overlooks together that Phil mentioned. And their funding, or their fundraising success and partnerships with CEP and Cardinal Greenways eventually built 6.5 miles of beautifully designed asphalt trail through Muncie along the river. However, phase five was what we called it because we built that trail in four phases. Phase five, we were unable to finish. This final portion of the trail system involved connecting the Cardinal Greenway and the White River Trail. The Cardinal Greenway is on the west side, and the White River Trail is on the east side, where you see the red dot. And the major issue involved was getting the trail users safely across the White River in order to connect those trails and make loops. The Cardinal Greenway, excuse me, here, just a minute, catch my thought. Well, fortunately, about 9 years ago, community leaders, along with CEP, developed a gateway concept that became our new vision. And this involved what you see today with the historical bridge. That's bridge number 85 located out, was located out south of Albany. I hope if there's any Albany folks here today that they'll understand that the bridge is being put to a very good use. The statement this refurbished bridge will make for pedestrian traffic is truly amazing. Another feature will be a large trailhead designed for school bus drop-off and pickup, which will complement our Learning on the Trails program. The Craddock Wetland, which is located just a short walking distance to the north, waits on children to enjoy and learn firsthand about nature's many marvels. We have a very active program on the trails now to bring school kids to the trail and learn about what's with nature and many things. So in closing, I'd like to say that CEP and Cardinal Greenways are truly delighted to be a partner in this amazing Great Way improvement for our project or for our community. We welcome your ideas and suggestions to continue to improve our community, and your donations and suggestions are always welcome. Thank you.
Okay, thanks, Tom. Mike Klein is next. He's going to talk about from the Muncie Sanitary District perspective. The sewers and things in this area have to be separated in order to make this project happen, and Mike's going to talk about their engagement in this project.
Good morning, and thank you. Is it the one on the right?
Just push the down here, okay?
That one. Okay, very good. I'm speaking from the Muncie Sanitary District today. The rest of our leadership team is here, Bill Smith, Joe Evans, and Nikki Grigsby. We were founded in 1965, which was just before John Craddock came on board. We employ 250 people. We handle all the trash, recycling, the sanitary sewers, the sewage treatment plant, the storm sewers, and the levee system, the flood control protection system. What we've done, we've been able to effectively utilize all of our financing revenue and our debt in a creative way, and developed an alternative construction delivery method known as guaranteed cost savings to take all the savings we have from our construction projects and plow them back into the neighborhoods where we're doing mandated but unfunded infrastructure work.